Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is artist, teacher at Clark University, director of the Studio Art Program in the Department of the Visual and Performing Arts. It's Toby Sisson. Sisson?
Yes, you got it.
An exhibition of her work titled Deconstructed American will be in view at the Howard Yuzerski Gallery from the 18th of October to the 26th of November. Toby, welcome back after too long an absence, and that's my fault.
Yeah, it's been 10 years, but it's really lovely to be here. Thank you.
And the funny thing is, I can vividly remember our first interview, and part of it is that you worked in caustic, which to me was like, holy smokes, not since the Fayum of Egypt have people worked with encaustic. And for people who don't know, before we start talking about your work, Okay. Just talk about encaustic.
Absolutely. It is not uncommon for people to be working in encaustic anymore. I know dozens, perhaps even hundreds.
At the time, it seemed like there was
contemporary artists who work in encaustic. But you're right. 10 years ago, when we first were in conversation, it was a little bit more unusual. I think it wasn't probably common knowledge for most art viewers, art goers, art appreciators, but those who work in the medium have a sense of its history and how there's been a resurgence in the use of encaustic, you know, really within the last 20 years, I would say. And it's picked up speed within the last decade, and it seems to be everywhere recently. And I still love the medium. I'm still completely seduced by it.
What about it? What is it that really catches you about this medium?
You know, it's so malleable.
You're working with wax.
I'm working with wax, molten wax. So you use it with heat as a printmaking medium, which is what I do most recently and most often. So I'm using heat to transfer images as opposed to pressure, which one usually uses with a press. But you can also paint with it. You can sculpt with it. It's really, really lovely. So
is it the tactile sense of it?
I mean, yeah, do you get to feel the heat? Tactile sense. You do feel the heat, but you know, you're working at a relatively low heat, under 200 degrees to keep it safe. So it isn't extraordinarily hot. It's not like casting metal. You don't need a foundry or anything like that. So I have a live work studio and I simply work there. Yeah, I think it is the texture of the material, that it's based in beeswax, so it has an absolutely lovely aroma. You know, it smells a little a beehive. It's a bit like honey. It also has translucency because the wax, when mixed with pigment, is semi-transparent, so the colors are jewel-like. Yeah, I really can't say enough about it. It's quite lovely.
Let's, before we get into in the history of you and that, let's talk about Deconstructed American. How many pieces are in the show?
Oh gosh, that's a quiz.
It seems like it's a big show. Is this a retrospective?
No, it's not quite a retrospective. It'll be my first time showing at Howard Yuzerski's Gallery in Boston, so I'm really excited about that on Harrison Ave in Sowa.
This is a big hint for everybody to show up.
Yeah, the opening is this Friday.
Okay.
The 18th of October, and I guess I'll have about under 20 pieces. We're still hanging the show this week, so the exact number of pieces that are going to make the cut, I'm a little unsure of. You know, you always bring more work than you think you're going to show so that you don't have too sparse a show.
Did you make any work specifically for the show?
Absolutely, I did. There's a few pieces that have appeared before, but there's some brand new work in this show that I'm very proud of. So I'm looking forward to it.
Now, let me talk to you about your work because I love your work. Okay.
Thank you.
And we were talking about this off mic. You're one of the few artists who seems to know how to write about your work in a way that causes the viewer, it doesn't tell them what it is exactly, but it leads them to a door to open to explore the work. In your artist statement on your website, it says, making my work is like drawing lines in wet sand with a long stick or composing a patchwork quilt from faded remnants. Often it's like walking under a vast night sky onto which I project my fantasies and fears. That's poetry.
Well, I love poetry. I guess that does show up a little bit in my statements. And anything that I write or say about my work, I'm thinking of it in a very lyrical sense.
It really is true. I mean, and then I bring that to the work and it opens up a different venue for me to look at it. Talk to me about your passion for abstraction.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've been involved with for probably maybe 20 years. I originally was trained in an art school, so I had the kind of classical training that one receives. So I do have the ability to work representationally, but I haven't for a very long time.
Well, talk to me about the discovery and the opening up of abstraction for you, your story in abstraction. Yeah. I think everybody comes to it from a different pathway.
Absolutely. I think I was looking for an opportunity to maybe be more poetic in my work, a little less declarative and a little more open. And I liked...
Less didactic?
Yeah, absolutely. I like the way non-objective abstraction, which is what I really do. I'm not necessarily referencing an object or something that you can name in the world. I'm thinking about ideas. I'm thinking about sense perceptions. I'm thinking about the emotional content of work. And for me, abstraction always felt like a better vehicle for that because it was open. It allowed for the viewer to also be able to bring their story to the work, to see something in the work that perhaps even I wasn't aware of. And it seemed endlessly fascinating for me. So it's just been a realm that I have never tired of. And I don't think there's any going back now.
You'll never go back to figurative work?
Yeah, probably not. I should never say never because many figurative artists that I really do love. It's just not my first language anymore.
You do occasionally work in letters.
Yes. Yeah. So and it's graphic.
I see work by Glenn Ligon and other artists like that. And it's like, it's not, you know, somewhat reminiscent of Glenn Ligon, but it's also reminiscent of Franz Kline. But it has a totally different thing. Talk to me about working in letters and in words. I mean, you're still not, you do it, but then I can see you deconstructing it too.
Absolutely. So the show is called Deconstructed American simply because I'm thinking about language very concretely. So I'm actually working in encaustic monotype, which is using encaustic in a printmaking method to construct the word American. So I'm printing the letters, you know, eight letters, AMERICAN. And then I'm cutting them up and fragmenting those letters so they become collage bits. And I'm thinking again about language poetically, and I want somehow to be able to deconstruct the word American, because we're at a point in history right now where I think we're really thinking about what identity, what Americanness is, who belongs, and who gets to say. How do we determine who we are in relationship to our nationhood? Do we feel as if we belong? Do others? Who gets to say? So I wanted to play with those ideas a little bit, and cutting up the word allowed me a way of saying, how have we sort of sliced and diced identity as an idea? And then I recombine those words as one would do with a collage, and I'm making very graphic patterns. I'm thinking about what that resembles. So what does being an American look like? I'm actually thinking of that quite literally. What does American, the word, look like if I cut it apart and put it back together? And that allows me to think about different perspectives on identity. I think I have a kind of unique perspective on my own identity, my relationship to nation, state, all these things. And that's what I really play with in my studio. I don't necessarily have any answers, but I really like the questions. And when you're making work, it allows you a space to explore possibilities.
Nasarima.
Ah, actually, that's just, you know, American backwards.
I
know, and the pronunciation
that, you know,
is Nakarima.
Nakarima. What was interesting is that I came across the word on your website.
Yeah.
And I didn't put it together, stupidly, that it was American backwards. And I went to do a search on it, and it's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. It's a whole couple things.
A whole couple of things.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. I mean, it started out, what, in anthropology?
Well, actually, I think it predates that. So I can talk about it in a couple of different ways. I was interested in the inversion of the word American. So if you just spell it backwards, one could pronounce it as you did. It wasn't wrong. But I think of it as Nakarima. I have a sort of early childhood reference to that word because my father belonged to a social club. And I actually did a little research on this recently. And when I was a child, I wasn't aware of the sort of proliferation of the social club Nacarima, which was an African-American social club in Minneapolis. I found out that it also was the name of a social club in lots of different sort of Midwestern and Western cities.
Always African-American?
Always African-American, as far as I could tell. And it was first established, I would say, probably as far back as the 40s, maybe even a little bit earlier, but I would say post-war, as a place for African-Americans to gather. Because in many places, there simply wasn't an opportunity to join clubs that the dominant culture would be a part of. So you weren't necessarily going to be a Shriner as an African-American, where I grew up at that time. So this was an alternative. This was a place where my community, my people, could be, socialize. And, you know, I don't think I recognized when I was a child how very subversive it was to sort of flip the word American and turn it into something else. But again, it's another perspective on identity. And I think it was sort of, you know, low key at the time, not recognized by a lot of people as a sort of subversive way to talk about belonging or not being able to belong. So I revived that as I was looking at this word American, thinking about how we are conceptualizing our identity today, and it caused me to reach back and think about my relationship to that word and Nacarima when I was a child. And as you pointed out, it also has some basis in anthropology.
There seems like there's a movement or people who have an idea to not take the usual way of analyzing culture and reversing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Anthropologists, I believe, and I could be wrong about this because I'm not an anthropologist, but from my little bit of research and delving into what other permutations of the word Nacarima exist, one of the things that I discovered was that anthropologists were wanting a way to analyze the culture and the society that they were in, and that was American culture. And so they flipped the word in order to be able to have sort of an objective distance to analyzing the space and the place within which you existed. So that, by calling it Nacarima, it was a way of looking at American without calling it out so explicitly.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is artist, teacher at Clark University, director of the Studio Art Program in the Department of Visual and Performing Arts, Toby Sisson. I'm going to I spent decades like referring to Sis. For some reason, I gave it this like French spin.
Well, it is the basis of it. It is French. It is French. But I certainly wouldn't force anybody to say Sisson.
Sisson.
No, it's just Sisson.
An exhibition of her work is going to be at the Howard Jerzyski Gallery, 10/18 to 11/26. And be sure to be there. 10/18 is the opening.
Yes, yeah, that's the opening reception.
You should go there.
And I'll be there on First Fridays, which is really big in Boston. That'll be November 1st. They'll also be having sort of a second opening. And that's where you can visit a lot of galleries that are on that same avenue. Lots and lots of
different. People are doing the same thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a gallery crawl every first Friday.
Wow.
In Soho, Boston. And I'll be a part of that this time.
Now, I want to talk to you about working in series.
Yeah.
Because you've done several series. Black Tears is one, which is a beautiful series. When did you start working on series?
You know, I feel as if all of my work is connected, and I probably hadn't really thought about working in discrete series until rather recently. There's a thread that runs through the concepts and the ideas, and also some of the formal qualities in my work. I usually work achromatically, at least I have for about the last 10, 12 years.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, working in a black and white palette. So there's some things that have remained constant, even as my work has changed medium. But for the series Deconstructed American, it's remained, you know, really tight in that it's all very graphic and it's all language based and it's all working around that one word, American, and all the different ways that I can play with it. The earlier series that you referenced, Black Tears, is something that happened and developed in late 2014, early 2015, when I was paying a lot of attention to the death, the murder of young unarmed black men in America. And like a lot of people, I was really struck by the tragedy, and I was grieving about that. And I was trying to think about a way that that grief could have an expression in my work. And I hadn't really thought of a way, again, because I'm not a figurative painter anymore, how would I be able to talk about this in the language of abstraction and be able to communicate something that was legible to an audience who's not looking at objects or things that they could name necessarily. So I was in my studio and I was really sort of meditating on the idea of grief and noticing that, you know, there were so many protests, there were so many rallies, there were so many things that were happening in, you know, all kinds of places in Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri, really all over the country, that was expressing a collective grief that was happening. And I was very aware of that. And I, in my studio, started making just a mark. I was working with ink because it was so quick and so immediate and so much like drawing. Didn't require some of the setup and complications that painting or printmaking can. And I was making this shape that was tear-like. And I was thinking about it in this sort of repetitive way. I just kept making tears. And I'm not actually sure what I was, why I was making that shape at the time.
Consciously.
Not initially. I think it was maybe even my subconscious was doing this a little bit. I don't know. It sounds a little odd to say that. But I was making this shape repeatedly, this tear shape. I mean, it could have been a stand-in for blood, could have been a stand-in for sweat or tears. But I kept making it over and over, and it struck me as if the impact of this mark was in the massing of it, in the repetition of it. And that reminded me of the collective outpouring of grief that I was hearing about on the radio. I'd listen to NPR sometimes in my studio, those news reports that I was connecting with, or the images of rallies that you would see on the nightly news. And that connection of making that repeated mark seemed to me to be somehow related to the collective outpouring of grief. So I kept making them. Then I started making them on individual pieces of watercolor paper and thinking that, you know, these perhaps have something to say, but I don't know what to do with them yet. And then I had a curator doing a studio visit from Yellow Peril Gallery, which is a wonderful space in Providence. And that curator was looking at other work, and he noticed the pile of tears that I had in my studio, and he says, "What's that?"
First of all, just the way that you said that, he noticed the pile of tears in my studio. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah, and so there, my studio was a pile of tears, you know, figuratively and literally. That's what I was feeling. And I think I didn't call attention to them initially because I didn't know what to do with them. I couldn't really figure out how they would work. And he helped me in conversations. Curators are wonderful, and museum curators, gallery curators, gallery directors, they're great to have these ongoing conversations with because they can give you kind of an objective view of your own work and help you see some things that you might be just starting to sneak up on yourself. So he and I were in this conversation about what these could become. And I thought of them as needing to be masked somehow, that, you know, one tear wasn't going to really do it. And he and I had a conversation about what they could become. We eventually hung a wall in Yellow Peril Gallery full of black tears. So it was a 20-foot long wall, and I can't remember, maybe 6 or 8 feet high, hanging of these tears. It was hundreds of them. And they're all unique. Right. So they're all individual marks that I've made. They're not reproduced. So they all have their own original quality. I remember in the beginning trying to make my mark identical so there'd be some kind of continuity or uniformity. That wasn't working. And then I realized that everyone's outpouring of grief, well, grief is unique. We all grieve in very individual ways. So then it seemed right that there's some variance in all of them. So it was a meditative act for me as an outpouring of my own grief that suddenly became a recognition of our collective grief that then became a way for me to visually talk about this and have that impact on a wall.
Doing a project like that, that's so deeply heartfelt. When you're finished, when you have the wall, is there a sense of emotionally in yourself that by exercising it, by putting it out to share with everybody, that you've lessened your grief a little bit, or maybe not lessened your grief is not the right term,
Well, I've had a chance to share the grief.
And that makes all the difference in the world, it seems.
I think so. I think that's what we need to do to connect.
Right.
And to understand what others are feeling and experiencing. This was an opportunity for me to connect with an audience even before that I knew that I was doing that. And I've seen by the response that people have to this particular work that it's significant for other people as well. And that's really satisfying for me.
Do you normally work in installation? Because this was, I've seen a photograph. That's definitely an installation.
Yeah, absolutely. No, not really. I tend to work on a number of pieces that are connected.
Right.
Yeah, a series or things that are connected by the thread of an idea that may or may not exist alongside one another on a wall or in a space. So this was a little bit unique in that regard. I've had an opportunity to show it a few times, which has been lovely. It was actually collected. 144 of the tears were collected by the Bell Gallery at Brown University.
Beautiful.
So I'm in their permanent collection, which means that this work can have a life beyond just shown in a gallery for a limited period of time. And if you don't catch the show, you don't really have the experience. Knowing that it exists alongside other work in their collection and has opportunities to be shown again and again in different kinds of situations, in different conversation with different artwork, is also very satisfying.
When I hear you talk about works like this and other works, there is a political, emotional aspect to your work.
Absolutely.
Yet at the same time, your work defies didactic appearance. And I want to ask you about the importance of aesthetics in your work, because I find your works beautiful without being direct. In other words, you've abstracted everything to a level where, yeah, there's certain interpretations of them, but they are beautiful works too.
Well, you know, maybe...
I mean, how important is aesthetics?
Aesthetics are very important to me. I'm, you know, in some ways I'm a formalist, and that's one of the things that comes from being in so involved with abstraction. You know, I'm really invested in the ideas behind my work, even if those ideas are not directly corresponding with what the viewer's imagination brings. But I'm deeply connected also with the formal qualities and beauty. So I think I'm trying to make work that's compelling, because I think if you can attract someone to keep their vision on your work for a period of time because the image is compelling or lyrical or poetic or any of those things that I'm aspiring to, then there's an opportunity for the meaning to be revealed.
Do you write poetry?
No, I'm sure if I did, it would be bad poetry.
Well, it's really easy to write bad poetry. That's I have a saying that writing bad poetry is the easiest thing in the world.
I like to read poetry.
Right.
And then my form of poetry would then
is
be
the
visual.
The artwork.
Yeah, would be the artwork.
We only have a few minutes left. I want to talk to you about when you do use color. For instance, Jimmy's Blues, there's a natural history, I think, that's got yellow in it.
Yeah.
When I come across it, it's startling. Because
You have to scroll through my website away.
But all of a sudden there's like
there's
this
some color.
Big thing of color. When you look back at your use of color, what are you thinking now? Are you happy with it? Do you want to explore that more? Or what do you want to do?
You know, I may go back to it again. Again, it's back to this never say never thing.
Right.
So I'm not ruling out the use of color. I often think, well, I wonder if I've exhausted the achromatic palette. You know, but I'm finding so much can be said with black and white, shades of gray, some silver, warmth and coolness, those variations within the black and white.
Reminds me of Franz
Actually
Kline.
A pretty big vocabulary.
Because he did use color occasionally. When I look at those works compared to his black and white works, I'm like,
I don't miss color at the moment.
Okay.
So if I return to color, it'll be because there's a natural impulse to do that, but I don't feel forced to do that right now. But I'm also not putting a ban on it. There's no reason for me, you know, to not use color. I just don't feel the need right now.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you, and I ask this of all artists, is that moment when you were comfortable calling yourself an artist, when you realize this is the thing that my life is going to center around. When did that occur to you, and then how did the process happen?
I think I've always been an artist, as many artists say. Did you draw as a child? Yes, absolutely. That was the best way to keep me sort of occupied, was my mother would hand me any kind of thing that I could write with. And I would write on an envelope or any scrap of paper, and I was pretty happy and content. But I don't think I recognized myself or felt like I was a bona fide artist until much later in life.
Were you encouraged to be an artist by your parents?
You know, my parents were incredibly creative people, not in a way that they probably would call themselves artists at all, but they were creative and they were into lots and lots of different kinds of activities.
What a great upbringing.
Yeah. And so my mother would take me to museums and places like that. So
that stuff matters.
Totally.
People don't realize how much that matters when you have a kid.
I latched on to it early, but I didn't really pursue formal education in the arts until much, much later in life. So I don't think I felt probably that that was going to be my identity until much later. Things happen.
What pushed you over the edge?
You know, I think it was seeing the work of, well, I always hung out with other artists. So that was a weird thing that I didn't see myself in that professional realm early on, but I hung out with a lot of musicians and I hung out with other people who were terribly creative people. And maybe I was a bit intimidated by that and I didn't think I was that of that same caliber. But I actually went to a thesis show of a friend of mine who was another bartender. I was a bartender for many, many years, decades. And she was going to art school simultaneously. So she was bartending part-time. I was bartending full-time. She invited me to her thesis show. I went and I was so moved by it. I was so impressed by her work. And I shared that with her. And she said, well, why don't you do it? And I was startled, actually, that she said that, because I thought, well, I'm too old. I wasn't serious enough. But she kept at me. And so I pursued workshops. I was prompted by her and other friends to kind of let that inner artist out and to be able to pursue it and not be so intimidated.
I often wonder how many other artists there are that could potentially exist that don't have some kind of social situation like this person.
Yeah. I mean, people can come to it at any time in their life.
Yeah, they can. And people need to remember that.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, if you don't have whatever is considered success or an art career or anything like that, it doesn't matter. You know, you can exercise your creativity, express your vision, share your love for something with the world. You don't necessarily need the title.
Yeah. Don't look at art as a money-making adventure, because it's not going to happen.
Well, very few people actually get rich doing it, but I don't think anyone that really enters into it, well, hopefully,
it's an emotional enterprise.
Yeah, it's an investment that you make in having a better life.
Wow, on that we're going to end. Okay. My guest tonight is artist, teacher at Clark University, director of the Studio Art Program there in the Department of Visual and Performing Arts, Toby Sisson. An exhibition of her work titled Deconstructed America,
American,
will be on view at the Howard Yuzerski Gallery, 10/18 to 11/26. Toby, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to you.
I love talking to you. It was great. You're listening to, and by the way, go to our website and read her statement. I only read part of it. It's really a wonderful statement, and you write about your work so well. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.